The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. We'll talk to Lyndon Burns in just a moment. He is the managing director of Plain Talking. Lots of plain talking about airlines in recent weeks. Tito Mboweni saying no holy cows, implying that he would like to see the airline shut down. Pravin Gordhan has got other ideas as Minister of Public Enterprises. He managed to get another 5 billion Rand out of National Treasury to keep the thing going. And of course, we had recently Comair saying that it is so fed up with the treatment that it gets and the service that it gets, or lack of service that it gets at the SAA Technical, that it's moving all of the stuff it can overseas until it sets up its own shop with Lufthansa. SAA putting a brave face on all of the fighting about it at the moment. And so we'll talk to Lyndon Burns all about that this evening. Dr. Azhar Jamini's got a perspective on the Middle East, Iran, sanctions, Donald Trump. MTN share price up 5% on the day. MTN having a very good session, as despite the fact that the company which owns 49% of Iran Cell could find itself at the wrong end of these sanctions. We'll do Stock Pick Monday. We'll talk to the chief executive of FNB Home Finance, Liam Klongo, about why they have decided to antagonize a critical constituency, and that is estate agents. Or do they simply see themselves as disruptors in the world of banking innovation? They've effectively created a mechanism for you to dodge estate agents, to do direct sales between yourselves if you are FNB clients, and cutting out the middleman, the estate agent. Oh, estate agents are very cross. Estate agents don't like being cut out of a deal. So Gordon Smart, the owner at Smart Properties, he'll talk to us this evening, his reaction to that. Ian Mann with his regular book review. And then Desmond Dube sounds a bit like this. He's got a throat infection. So he's not saying very much at all. So we will bring you one of our previous fabulous Make Money Monday special edition guests and give Desmond Dube a chance to recover his voice.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106
Coming up in the next
FM.
20 minutes, your chance to win 1,000 Rand in cash, courtesy of 702 Keptalk and Mercantile Bank, the business bank inspired by entrepreneurs. Your question this evening: of which country is Hassan Rouhani the president? Of which country is Hassan Rouhani the president? That is your fast fact question this evening. I would like answers, please, to 31702 or 31567. Get those through to us as soon as possible. It is the 5th of November. November is the 11th month of the year. So correct answer number 11. Hey, how's that for science? You think it's random. Of course it's not random. And we will do the fast fact with the 11th correct answer on 31702. 31567 this evening. Of which country is Hassan Rouhani the president? That coming up in the next 19 minutes or so.
702. SMS Bruce on 31702.
I do wonder how many South African delegates to the World Travel Market in London travelled there on SAA. If you are a Durban delegate or a Cape Town delegate, you could have gone on British Airways or any one of the multitude of other airlines that travels from those cities via other destinations. But you could have got to the World Travel Market that way. From Joburg, you had a far greater choice of airline. You wouldn't have to go on SAA. Besides, SAA doesn't have that many seats available to London anymore. The reality is that you do. You have plenty of choice, more than ever before, thanks to this extraordinary chasm left by SAA and all its travails for global markets to take full advantage of. BA just last week introduced new direct flights to Durban, and I saw over the weekend that Austrian Airlines is offering a direct flight to Vienna as well. So more international airlines coming into this market. Tito Mboweni, in the medium-term budget policy statement, said there'd be no holy cows, and then signed a 5 billion rand check for Pravin Gordhan to deal with as Minister of Public Enterprises at SAA. Lyndon Burns, the Managing Director at Plain Talking. We've certainly got some plain talking from Tito Mboweni. We've also then got some Pravin Gordhan talking about planes, Lyndon Burns.
We should have indeed, Bruce. Good evening.
Should it stay or should it go?
Look, I think the fundamentals are still very strong to support a South African airline that serves our markets beyond the borders. You can have a separate ideological debate about the ownership, and to be honest, I'm quite agnostic on that. There are enough failed privately owned airlines as much as there are many successful state-owned airlines. So I think it's down to the governance, the management, the business nous. I think the biggest challenge at the moment, I think that, SAA's CEO, when he took over a year ago, inherited basically what was a shopping trolley with four car steering wheels pointing in different directions. And you ain't going to push a shopping trolley forward if you haven't got the wheels aligned and they're not turning. And I think that what we saw last week is really a kind of shock tactic to try and get some momentum going now. One of the key car steering wheels that needs to be aligned are the unions and the working staff of the personnel of SAA. And if you ain't got them behind you, it doesn't matter how many turnaround strategy papers you write, it's going to be worthless. And I thought it was fascinating to see the reaction to Tito Mboweni's little hand grenade over the weekend when the NEC first came out and said, we've taken stock of what the alliance partners have got to say, I mean the SACP, Cassato, etc., and we'll now engage with them to get them to align behind us on pushing us in the right direction.
I mean, it's a lovely airline. Domestic routes are staffed by great people. They're gifted pilots, but it's a financial mess. I mean, this is not just the legacy of Dudu Mieri, although she helped dig the hole deeper. This is a legacy that goes back 20 years and more.
Bruce, it goes back 25 years. I mean, SAA has been crying to be properly recapitalized for as long as I can ever remember, at least back to the early 90s. I remember still under the old Nat Party government, the plan was to try and get it financially sustainable, and they were going to list the airline on the JSE at the time. Then we had the change in 94. And unfortunately, all that's happened is that the government has just given it a succession of piecemeal little bailouts to settle immediate short-term debt and has never really grappled with the proper recapitalization of the airline. And so things have just escalated. And to be fair to government, they've had a lot of other spending priorities to focus on, but at the same time hoping that SAA would pull itself right. Now, yes, we could argue there's been a succession, a revolving door of leadership, and every time a new one comes in, so the old turnaround strategy gets replaced. At the same time, one of SAA's biggest challenges is the exposure to forex. You know, the aviation industry trades largely in dollars. SAA generates the majority of its revenue in rand and other softer currencies. So that gap kind of yawns wider every time the economy takes a hit and the rand weakens or other currencies strengthen. So it's got a number of challenges that it's got to address, not just labor, not just the governance issues. There are some other things that work against it. What works in its favor, though, is that the market fundamentals are very strong. We're seeing demand for air transport into, out of, and within this region at an annual rate of 5.6% growth. That's compound growth. That means that the size of the market is growing every 15 years.
Which makes it that much more of a crime that South Africa's missed out on that. I mean, this is a slightly old stat, but I think it goes back to 2016 arrivals. Cape Town International saw a 26% increase in international airline arrivals in 2016. And that's quite soon after SAA dumped the London Cape Town route, where Virgin come in, BA lay on extra flights. Then just last week, BA comes in with a couple of Durban flights a week, and Austrian with flights to Vienna. The rest of the world is going, look, there is no competition. Let's go.
Well, you know, it's quite interesting. I was just looking at some market forecast figures for different market flows to and from South Africa. And we look at, South Africa, People's Republic of China. We're looking at 11.4% annual growth over the next 10 years. That's phenomenal that we've got to try and capitalize on. If you look at the top 20 traffic flows in the world forecast over the next 20 years, the top, amongst the top 20 are Sub-Saharan Africa to the PRC, Middle East, South Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East. If we were to look at South Africa, South America, I'm thinking of them because of BRICS, 4.5% in the next 10 years, annual growth, 5% a year in the subsequent 10 years. So there's a lot of opportunity. Now, a lot of people also think that SAA has done itself out and sold its rights to compete on those routes. It actually hasn't. Our traffic rights that we have in South Africa, we still use a mechanism or a set of instruments called bilateral air transport agreements, and they work on the basis of reciprocity. So for every flight that is allocated to a foreign airline, a South African carrier has the right to a reciprocal amount of capacity and frequency in that same market. So if it would want to, South African Airways certainly has the opportunity to get back in. Now, there are some airports that may be slot-constrained, like Heathrow, where we made a mistake selling a slot at Heathrow, which is like gold's dust. You don't do that, but there are other gateways into the UK.
By any rational measure, SAA should be closed up. I mean, it is insolvent. It is not making any money. It's got terrible leases on old aircraft. It can't compete against new generation aircraft. It takes too much money to get the things off the ground. It takes too much money to fly them from A to B and beyond, and then land them all again and then do it backwards again after that. So it's a rubbish business. It's not working, and it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked for an awfully long time. We should shut it down. There's one argument. We could make shares available to the South African public. We could use public investment corporation funding to do that. My market commentator, Peter Brook, has just gone pale. We could perhaps we could do what the Swiss did. We could say, this is a beautiful tail fin. Let's sell it to the highest bidder and make some money. That's what the Swiss did.
Closed their airline, and then Lufthansa started a new one. The same with Sabena in Belgium. That's one way to go. Of course, there's nothing to also stop the airline going and renegotiating its leases and its financial, its loans with people. We had an Air Finance Africa conference in Sandton a couple of months ago, and speaking to the people at Nedbank, Investec, RMB, they're all saying, look, the appetite to fund and provide finance to SA is not diminished in any way, but we want to know that there's a credible business plan, and we want to know that government or whoever is going to be owning it is going to back and stand surety. If all of that's in place, we're happy to talk business, because they recognize the fundamentals are still there.
Lyndon Burns, thank you very much indeed. The Managing Director, Plain Talking, Lyndon Burns. There is still an appetite for air travel, but is SAA the right vehicle for it, I wonder? Tito Boweni threw a hand grenade into the debate. Pravin Gordhan is trying to keep the debate nice and calm. Certainly Vuyani Jahana, the quotes I've seen from him, he's the chief executive, is trying to stay optimistic. But boy, what a horrible job he's had over the last 12 months trying to turn that monster around and yet to see some results. Lyndon Burns at Plain Talking. Thank you.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Peter Brook with the Old Mutual Investment Brook. Old Mutual Investment Group. I didn't know they changed the name. Peter Brook this evening, our market commentator. Peter Brook, give us a sense of today's markets, building on last week's gains. Last week was a fabulous week. The JSE, which at one point looked at would tip into the 40,000s and stay there, is practically 10% up over 2 weeks.
Well, if you look at the month to date, we're now plus 4.5. So,
and that's the month of November after Red October, yes.
Yeah, 1% today. And it just highlights how that this volatility, if you panic out, oh my goodness, the market's crashing, you miss the rebound. And it's actually the importance of sticking with your plan, because markets are volatile. But the main thing today, I think, was a lot of company news. We had trading statements from AngloGold, Barloworld, Massmart. We had results from Redefine, the property group. And then a bit of news from ABSA.
It's a management change at ABSA, and it was our blue chip challenge question on 702 this afternoon, that the guy who used to be the Eskom finance director is now in charge of all the tech at ABSA. But let's move on to the Anglo Gold one, which is quite interesting because they hardly mine any of their gold anymore in South Africa. They've got the deepest mines in the world in South Africa, but less and less of what they do is here.
That is true. So they had reasonably good cost control, and you can see the market liked it. The shares were up a little bit. What I find interesting is part of their efficiency was no lost time injuries. And actually, your ability to mine safely is so critical nowadays. And I contrast that with Sibanye-Stillwater, who actually produced very bad numbers a little while ago, where they had a number of incidents. But the difference is Anglo Gold is up 18.5% over the last month, and Sibanye's down 7.7%. So actually, the way you treat your staff, your environmental, social, or to be fair, it might just be the technical difficulty of mining those mines. I mean, I don't want to make a broad statement, a value judgment.
The point is, the Department of Mineral Resources steps in when there's an accident, says, until we figure this out, until we're going to try and stop it from happening again, you can't mine. And that sets back operations for ages. Sibanye has more accidents than Anglo Gold Ashanti, which mines, you know, deeper, some of the deepest mines in the world. It's managing fewer issues, and therefore it is performing better, and also greatly diversified worldwide, perhaps, than Sibanye-Stillwater is. Then Massmart in a tough space, that retail space. We've seen ShopRite come under pressure. Pick and Pay looks like it's got early signs of a turnaround. How's Massmart coping in the melee of retail?
So Massmart, what was interesting about their trading statement is they put one out at 43 weeks now, and their last one is at 33 weeks. So you can get a little bit of a sense of just shift in momentum. And the truth is, the numbers are gradually picking up a little bit. So if you strip out the noise of deflation and store openings, roughly volumes grew about 2%. So we've actually starting to get some positive volume growth. And I think there's very gentle signs of things picking up a little bit month by month out there. And that's positive. And we actually saw, you mentioned ShopRite, was up strongly on the back of Massmart's trading statement.
It does indicate to us that perhaps we are out of the recession. I mean, that the third quarter numbers aren't out yet. We had where are we? Did we have quarters 2 and 3 in recession, or was it 1 and 2 in recession? I think it was 1 and 2 in recession. It's easy to lose track of these things, but we're probably out of recession.
The nice thing about recessions is they often vanish by themselves because the figures get restated. So the bottom line is it feels like we're in the trough. We're in the bad time, and it's starting to get a little bit better. You know, Barla World's trading statement, they're talking about the logistics business having to shut down or cut costs because volumes were down. And that's the trough, and now we can look forward to things getting a little bit better.
No, good news. I mean, we need a bit of good news after all of the bad news we've had in South Africa in recent times. I was surprised to see how strong MTN was, considering Donald Trump is wanting to sort of almost have a blockade of every Iranian port and every Iranian trade, anything to do with Iran. MTN's got a 49% stake in Iran Cell, and Donald Trump threatening hellfire and brimstone on anyone who does business with Iran.
Yeah. Telcos was actually the best performing sector today, up over more than 4%, and MTN was a big part of that. I'm obviously happy because we bought some MTN when it when it crashed out recently. It just looked a little bit too cheap. But I don't think there wasn't any specific news that drove that up. I think it was just a bit of bid in the market.
Good day on the JSE. Some nice corporate updates coming out today. The market up 644 points. We closed virtually at 55,000 on the all share index. That's a 10% swing from its low, its October low, in which it nearly went below the 50,000 level. Peter Brook with the Old Mutual Investment Group. Thank you very much. Fast fact question time. Aisha in Robertson, please answer my question tonight, which is, of which country is Hassan Rouhani the president?
Hi, the answer is Iran.
It is Iran, Aisha, and you are a 1,000 Rand better off, courtesy of those nice people at Mercantile Bank, and we'll make sure that you get that 1,000 Rand. Rouhani vowing to stand up against U.S. President Donald Trump, describing his sanctions as the toughest ever. Of course they are against Iran. MTN's got that 49% stake in Iran Cell. And Aisha, you've won yourself 1,000 Rand, courtesy of 702 Cape Talk and Mercantile Bank, the business bank inspired by entrepreneurs. And for another chance to win, head over to the 702 and Cape Talk websites. Enter the online Fast Fact competition. There's 1,000 Rand up for grabs there each week, courtesy of 702 Cape Talk and Mercantile.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Our unemployment issues have gone so far beyond crisis point, it's frightening. It really is. And the odds of getting a job if you have never had a job, the odds of getting a job if you've just lost your job in particular industries, mining is a notable one. But yeah, getting jobs is harder and harder to do, and youth unemployment particularly on the rise. And with the economy doing really poorly, how do we then tackle this problem, this huge unemployment issue? 10 o'clock on Wednesday, that's this week, 7th of November, we'll present the Job Summit, or another one, but this one with Eusebius. Eusebius Mackayser, to try and find solutions, particularly to youth unemployment, to be part of the audience. If you want to be part of the audience, you want to come and have your say, or at least tap into the zeitgeist of what is being said directly at the event with Eusebius, contact at 702.co.za. That is the email address, contact at 702.co.za. Eusebius hosting that event in Joburg this Wednesday.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield.
Live.
Online.
Smartphones.
DSTV.
And 92.7.
And 106 FM.
Well, just how are these US sanctions on Iran going to affect South Africa? Dr. Zahar Jameen, Chief Economist at Econometrics. Should we be worrying? Should we lose sleep? Can we gnash our teeth? What should we be doing?
Bruce, the main way in which it has an impact on the South African economy nowadays is through the oil price. And what we've seen, for example, is that in the last few months, ever since President Trump announced the reimposition of sanctions on Iran, oil prices shot up on the expectation that that would result in a decrease in the supply of oil on international markets, bearing in mind that Iran accounts for between 3 and 4% of total world oil production capacity. And conversely, in the last few days, on account of, well, in fact, it started a few weeks ago, there were rumors that President Trump would not act against other countries as harshly as he had threatened, should they not stick to the sanctions very strictly. And the oil price started coming off. And especially in the past week, there have been expectations that Iran was, that the U.S. was going to allow 8 different countries to waive the sanctions against Iran and not take action against them. And though many of those are its major, is the U.S.'s major trading partners in Asia, including China. And so the implication is that maybe there won't be such a shortage of supply out of Iran after all. And as a result, oil prices have fallen through, fallen 16% in total since their peak.
You've got to wonder what the point is then of Donald Trump's George Orwell against Iran. I mean, yes, he doesn't like the nuclear exposure that Iran may or may not have. He doesn't like what their intentions may or may not be with exposure to nuclear, yet insists on these sorts of sanctions. I mean, does a company like MTN, which has got that 49% stake in Iran Cell, and possibly Sasol, which did have, and I'm not sure if it does still have, projects in Iran in terms of gas to liquids, I think it was, do they have a problem?
They may well have a problem. They may be scared that they don't fall under the 8 countries that enjoy, if I could call it, most favoured status from the United States. And for that matter, South Africa as a whole was compelled to... South Africa used to get most of its oil from Iran. And when sanctions were originally imposed several years ago on Iran, South Africa had to find new sources of crude oil and now doesn't import anything from Iran anymore. So it does feel intimidated by the United States.
Dr. Zahar Jameen, thank you very much indeed. Perspective this evening on the Iran threat, the Iran sanctions threat, Donald Trump threatening all kinds of retribution on people who break the sanctions. But as Zahar Jameen so neatly puts it, we're in a stage in the way the world has developed and the power that other countries have got where the U.S. seems to be losing its punch when it comes to imposing things like these sorts of sanctions. I'd be interested to know from the likes of Sasol and the likes of MTN whether or not they do lose sleep at night as a result of these threats.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield.
Live.
Online.
Smartphones.
DSTV.
And 92.7.
And 106.
Stock Pick Monday in a couple of moments' time. I must just tell you that on the next Money Show, we're looking at the science of advertising. Standards Authority with Gail Schimmel. She was sick last week, so we've invited her back. JJ Cornish with the Africa Business Focus. And then branding and advertising expert Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. All of that is coming up on the next Money Show, and we'll see whether or not markets have maintained the upward momentum they've developed over the last week.
The Money Show.
Stock Pick Monday.
Stock Pick Monday brought to you by BEE Connects, a division of the LFP Group. Pietri Heldene, Pietri Redlinge, I beg your pardon. Pietri, I'm going to try that again. Pietri. I'm going to put this off. I'm going to pretend that never happened. Pietri Redlinghuis is the founder of Herenia Capital Advisors. How was that for a second take? That wasn't bad, hey?
You know, much better. Yeah, I've been dealing with that problem my whole life, though. You know, most people got a surname. I got, like, a whole sentence. So you did. I forgive you. It's okay.
Thank you, Pietri. Transaction Capital. Now, this is an interesting one. This is the one that when Mark Lamberti was sort of semi-retired from Massmart and before he went to Imperial and then retired, he ran Transaction Capital for a bit, and it always seemed a bit of a weird fit for me. This is a company that does micro-lending and taxi finance, essentially.
Well, not just that. They also have Transaction Capital Risk Services, which does, preparing small SMMEs for, becoming credit providers. For example, if you're a manufacturer and you want to give 30 days or 60 days credit to one of your suppliers or to one of your customers, whatever the case is, they prepare you for that. And they also have, a very large debt collecting business, probably the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere, actually. So they act as both principal or agent in collecting debt from retailers or whatever the case is. So if you ever get those SMS saying, hey, listen, make a payment plan, odds are that's Transaction Capital that's either bought your debt and is trying to, earn back some of it, or is working as an agent on behalf of someone collecting debt. And then, of course, as you say, there is the taxi business, which is an absolutely huge business. I think this is something that is usually exciting, because as Africa grows, I don't foresee a future in Africa where everybody in the up-and-coming middle class and the growing middle class is going to buy a car in the long run. I think that over time, public transportation infrastructure will improve, but I do not think that the taxi industry is going anywhere. If you look at a 10 or 20-year time horizon, I think the taxi industry in South and all of Africa, and for that matter, will only ever get bigger. And here we have a company that's the only one in the field at this stage, actually, providing finance solutions as well as maintenance plans and insurance and tracking services and all sorts of add-ons around that industry and supporting and helping that industry grow. So I think that this is a company that's very well positioned to capitalize on the African growth story from an infrastructural or transport perspective. You know, don't own the freight, but own the railroad, right?
Gotcha.
I think that this is where they are positioned.
Okay, go thumbs up for Transaction Capital. Let's go to Canada, where you want to invest in dope.
Very elegantly put, hey? In cannabis, Bruce. In truly cannabis, yes. So it is a new listing. It's actually only been listed for about a month. Listing prices are something like $6, the IPO price. It traded all the way up to almost $24 or just over $24. Currently trading at around $14.25. So this is Canadian dollars. So it's been a volatile ride, but this is probably, so True Leaf Cannabis is the biggest and the first manufacturer and distributor of marijuana or cannabis in the state of Florida in the United States. They have around 17 dispensaries. They've got 90 different products. They call themselves the seed-to-sale business, so they have that entire supply chain in place. And they serve something like 80,000 patients, and they've got 450,000 square feet of production, that's available to them, or production facilities available to them. Basically, land that they're farming. You know, they're farming marijuana, for lack of a better term. And I think that this is, there's been a lot of these hot stock IPOs that's been coming out. This is just another one of them. But what the advantages are here is that this is a probably the biggest one that we've seen in terms of the size of the company, the size of the customer base, and also financially are doing a bit better. They're actually not running at a loss. They're actually making a profit, which is unlike many of the other ones. So cool. I think that as far as pot stocks go, it's something that you need to keep an eye on.
Not hot stocks, but pot stocks. We'll take it. Vesarion. Now, this is a UK-listed company. I know nothing about this one.
So Vesarion is, as you say, UK-listed, yes. It basically does three different things. The first is that it does hardware. So not hardware, hardware, like the stuff that you wear, right? So they make basically carbide hard-wearing pants. And they sell this stuff to people in the oil industry, the gas industry, metals, sort of metal cutting industry. So heavy industry where if you don't want to cut your leg off, so you wear a pair of these pants. So they supply those. And they also do thermal products, so thermal and heat protective products. So they do porous copper and aluminium thermal heat sinks, right? And this goes obviously very much into the technology space. So if you're looking at big server farms that use this, telecommunications companies would use this, transportation companies would use this, aerospace companies, defense companies. Those are some of the products or some of the customers that they have for this thermal and other product business or business units within the company. And then there's the last one, which is probably the most exciting one, which is they are the world's first industrial manufacturer of a material called graphene. So graphene is basically like a new material that's been around. Harvard and MIT have been messing around with this for some time. What it can do is it can, it acts as a superconductor. It is also incredibly heat resistant, and you can build it one molecule at a time. So you can literally make a little wire that is one molecule thick, that is heat resistant and as conductive as any sort of semiconductor in a CPU processor at this point. So with that comes a push for the company to start manufacturing in China. They've recently started construction on a plant there so that they can be positioned closer to chip manufacturers so that they can supply them with graphene. And we can start seeing graphene in stuff like wearable technology, as well as, you know, Moore's Law, the faster processes get, the smaller they have to get. So this is going to be one of those future materials that we might not necessarily understand all the applications of it yet. There's still a lot of research to be done. Mm. But, you know, over the next 10 or 20 years, electronics will probably have a very graphene core processing system in them at one point.
My thanks to Pietri Redingase, the founder of Herenia Capital Advisors.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Look at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. Do you see money differently? Nedbank, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. Struggling to get hold of Lee Mtlongo at FNB. Kind of important that we talk to Lee first to truly understand why the bank has taken the decision to provide an opportunity to its clients to circumvent estate agents. And, I mean, it's part of disruptive innovation, I suspect. But we'll talk all about that this evening. Plus, tonight, we've got Ian Mann, our regular book reviewer, managing director at Gateways Business Consultants. And then Desmond Dube has called in sick. Well, didn't call in sick. He sent an email because he's got no voice. And he was going to be our Make Money Monday special edition guest. So instead of Desmond, he came through quite late. We're going to bring you a bit of Jesse Clegg. And Jesse Clegg, of course, was our Make Money Monday's guest some point last year. Lovely chat with Jesse. So looking forward to sharing that with you this evening on The Money Show. Now, I've met some wonderful estate agents, some really great professionals, but I always find the relationship chills when you talk about the C word. You know that C word that you talk about, estate agents? Yeah, the commission. And then you start talking about how you would like a bit of a discount on the commission. You know that your property is going to sell easily and sell well. And though the 7% standard or whatever it is nowadays is a little bit too high, or 6% or 5% or whatever it is. And then they get a little bit less warm towards you. But certainly estate agents' commissions are pretty hefty. Sometimes they're earned. Some estate agents work blimmin' hard to seal a deal. Sometimes the money falls into their lap. One buyer, and then the offer comes in close to the price, and they say, oh, we should have that chat, you know, that chat that we need to have. And they say, you know what, I know you didn't get your asking price, but, you know, the first price is usually the best price. I really think you should sell this one, because what they want to do is get you to sign on the dotted line as quickly as possible so that they get that house off their books and they can harvest the commission in a couple of months' time and get the next deal done. That's the nature of the estate agency business. They're very keen to get your property shifted. It's certainly my personal experience. What value do estate agents bring? They claim they've got hot and ready clients. They claim to know the local market. They claim to understand pricing. That's probably where the value comes from. You might be old school and be willing to give away a lot of value on your house. You may be willing to give away 5-7% on the purchase price in terms of commission. I mean, on a million-rand house, that's 70,000 rand that could have gone into your bank account that goes into the estate agent's bank account. So what FNB has done is found a way to circumvent that. Liam Klongo is the Home Finance Chief Executive at FNB. Explain to me how this works, Lee.
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening to your listeners. Thanks for the introduction. You're absolutely right. There are some estate agents that perhaps fit the narrative that you've explained. But also in the same token, let's also be fair to the sector. There are some exceptional estate agents that basically deliver on the service that's written on the tin.
So how does your offering work? You're offering to avoid the estate agents. You've created a mechanism, an online mechanism, that allows buyers and sellers to meet via the FNB app.
Correct, Bruce. I think if we'd like to take a look at our journey as FNB, we are offering a lot of innovations within our sort of banking environment. Lots of those innovations manifest themselves in our digital offerings. But throughout time, all of these innovations have led to a better quality of engagement in our face-to-face environment. So this innovation that we're doing will allow customers who are KYC'd or we've done all the identification of the customers to engage with sellers who are on that platform, and when required, bring in the appropriate professionals to facilitate that transaction, ensuring everyone gets a win-win.
The appropriate professionals, so no estate agents involved. You're a bit like Tinder for house sellers then. Swipe left if you like the house, swipe right if you don't, and you sort out the meetup. What you guys do then is the Tinder daters decide to get married and they need a priest and a lawyer to do the prenup. You get those professionals in the room.
Bruce, you are certainly right. For some people, Tinder is the way to go. So, yes, they would swipe on their own. Others may want a matchmaker to, operate for them. We believe in a multi-channel approach to, customer engagement. What we are trying to do with this offering is just create a healthy environment so that the appropriate channel for the customer can be brought to bear, resulting in a healthy, effective property ecosystem. So we are in for the individuals who'd like to do it on their own, but also equally because property buying is a highly emotive journey. I mean, you can imagine making a purchase, which in many instances is the most significant personal investment that most people will make. Sometimes you may want to have a friend in there. So in this channel offering, we've got that opportunity for estate agents to continue playing that prominent role they play in the market.
Okay, so estate agents can be part of this process, but it is just a way for people to meet sellers and buyers. Give me a sense of what this costs, because the last time I checked, you guys didn't give away anything for nothing.
Bruce, our role as a responsible lending entity is to create an enabling environment for all role players in a particular sector to operate. So as it stands now, this platform is for free. We have not put any charges on this platform. The idea behind it is listening to our 8 million plus customers' feedback in terms of where do they start this journey. This is our initial response to this type of journey.
If you're going to introduce me to lawyers and to other professionals, surely there's going to be a cost associated with that. Do you not get some sort of return for your efforts?
At this point, there is no charge. Later on, we may explore alternative revenue schemes out of this particular offering. But at this point in time, our mission was to provide a solution on our platform that allows better trust to be built with all players. We engage with customers very early on in their sort of financial journey, very early on when they're doing their planning. And what we found over time is that a lot of these customers tend to ask a basic question once they've gone through, let's call it the lender's narrative of this conversation. They've done their sort of calculators. They've done their sort of pre-qualification. Now they say, where to next? This platform just allows us to take them to that next step, whether it's go shopping on your own, or here's a panel of professionals that are available to like help you with this journey. That's what we're trying to help customers like, you know, overcome, because it is quite a daunting task to purchase a home.
Most certainly is. Liam Khlongo, thank you very much for spelling it out for us. Liam Khlongo is the Home Finance Chief Executive at FNB. Somebody who's not happy with FNB one little bit is Gordon Smart, who's on the line to us from Port Elizabeth, the owner of Smart Property. Gordon Smart, why are you threatening hellfire, brimstone and boycotts against FNB?
Hi there, Bruce. Yeah, no, look, I posted a post on, or shared something on Facebook, which got quite a bit of reaction. It was more, I won't say tongue-in-cheek, but it was to get the feeling of other operators in our industry. But yeah, it obviously opened up a can of worms, and some are really against it, threatening to close accounts with FNB and the whole lot. So yeah, look, I'm pretty much open-minded. I see what the banks are doing, going more digital, in terms of closing, reducing the number of branches, and it's something that we're going to have to live with in the future. But immediately, I think it was a bit of a sideswipe. It caught us unaware, and a lot of agents feel threatened because the banks are now competing with us, or F&Bs are competing with us, in terms of letting the clients go directly to them and cutting out the agent. Yeah, I think it's really, we are living in a changing environment in terms of if you don't get on board with technology, and you will be left behind. So I'm an independent operator, and I think the larger estate agencies, the franchises, Pam Golding's already bought an online operation. Some of the other agencies might be looking at it, but I think they're going to try and dig their heels in as long as possible. But immediately now, the banks come to us on one end looking for business, but then on the other end are taking it away by directing their clients straight to their app.
Yeah, it is a sign of the times, as you gracefully concede. And in a particularly in an environment where we don't see property prices moving particularly much, the cost of living is going through the roof, and everybody's looking to save a few percentage points wherever they can. The battle, I suppose, for estate agents into the future is going to be the value add to really justify the service level, and it's going to put huge pressure on estate agents to improve service levels, one would think.
I think that's you've just said it. You've got to lift your game and get out there and offer something better than the next guy. And if you don't do that, you're going to fall off. And I think most people are aware the amount of agents that actually make it in the industry or the retention rates is relatively low. I've been in the industry for 20 years now. I think every day is different, and you've got to keep looking at new horizons where you can actually lift your game and improve service levels to your clients, and then be able to justify those commissions that we do charge. I'm not saying that our commissions are over the top, but it varies. But we do carry a lot of costs. We've got overheads. And if it's just been proven in the past over the years, if agencies come up with low commission models, they don't actually survive. They just cannot cover the overheads in terms of traveling, running offices, the backups. And the estate agents board is putting a lot of demands on estate agents today in terms of qualifications and annual fees that we pay. The costs just keep mounting.
Yeah, I mean, do you see an offering like this from an FNB which can afford to swallow a lot of cost, I suspect, and at some point they'll find a way to monetize their particular offering, whether it be that they put you in touch with lawyers who pay commissions or whatever the case might be. A service like this is a potentially large disruptor, because here you've got a bank with deep pockets who can change the way in which the business works, the entire business works.
Yeah, look, I think it could initially give us a little bit of, as I said, it's a wake-up call. I don't think it's going to impact dramatically on our business. You've just got to look at the way you operate and change your direction and then head back. I think it has been a bit of a wake-up call, as I said, to get moving on either getting into technology, hybrid agencies. That's stuff for the future we're looking at, and I think it's the way to go. I'm pretty much looking in those directions myself. So I'm not going to just dig back into the old-fashioned estate agency world and try and do what I've done over the last 20 years. It's not going to work in the future. So And I also don't believe the banks are all going to go the same route as FNB. I think the other banks, I had a discussion with one of the homelands managers of, well, the regional homelands manager of one of the larger banks as well, and they're not going to be competing with us. So at this stage, it's only FNB that's come out with the app, and I don't think it's going to really impact us greatly.
Gordon Smart, thank you. He is the owner of Smart Property in Port Elizabeth. Massively outspoken in the beginning of this thing, going, oh, we should close our accounts and FNB is going to compete with us and why should we give them business? And you know, lots of outrage. At the same time, appreciating the fact that the world is changing and that if you do want to transact, there's a heightened risk, I suppose, in dealing directly with somebody that you don't have an experienced intermediary. But so often, I mean, and this isn't always the case, so often there's a form-filling exercise that happens. The estate agent sits down with you if you're a buyer, or sits down with you if you're the seller. They know how to fill in the forms, and they do it fairly quickly and painlessly. And then they submit those forms, and the process, if it all goes swimmingly and everybody pays their deposits and everybody does what they're supposed to do on time, the process largely is run by the conveyancing attorney. So how much is there really? Should we be paying estate agents for doing in the marketing of a property, which can be a really quick one or a really long drawn out process if the market is against you or if the pricing is wrong or whatever the case is, and in which case they've been a lousy estate agent? Just what is the value of the estate agent? That is what you will have to decide in choosing whether or not to go direct. Ian Mann, our property book reviewer this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Business books.
Ian Mann from Gateways Business Consultants. I want to say our regular book reviewer, but I haven't seen you for ages. Where have you been?
Been around,
been busy.
Indeed.
Business good in a recession? Business good in a recession?
Good is, it depends what you're doing. You know, are doctors busy when people are sick? And I think so.
Okay, so you've been busy.
We have indeed.
Jason Fried has written a book called It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. I suppose it depends where you put the punctuation in this. What does he mean by it doesn't have to be crazy at work? I mean, workplace is crazy or yeah.
He uses the term crazy very much the same way as we say, you know, I was driving to work this morning and the traffic was absolutely crazy. It's not really talking about the people in the cars as much as the volume of cars and the way that they're around and the fact that it was raining as well and the street is narrow and all sorts of other things. So it's a context of work which he says is crazy. But there's another part to this craziness. I'll tell you what the craziness is. The craziness is that work doesn't happen at work. You ask most people, where do you get most of your work done? And I defy you to find people who will say, when I need to work, I go to work in the morning and I get most of my work done. You do your work on planes, you do your work in coffee shops, you do your work hiding someplace, but your work seems to be like an interruption factory and we just don't seem to get stuff done.
You're so right.
And the interesting part about this is that if we were going to have a workplace that really worked, it would have to be, and this is the term that he uses, it would have to be calm. It would have to be calm. In a calm place, your time would be respected and you'd actually be able to have work-life balance. Just to put in, I think it's quite important to mention who Jason Fried is. He runs a company called Base Station, which is, it's like a collaborative medium of communication for businesses. And he's been running this for probably close on 2 decades and it's worth about $500 million. So it's not like, somebody who's never done that, this is how he runs his business and he has been successful. The whole thing is that he says this place has, your workplace has got to be calm. Let's just think of what that would imply. At work, we don't protect our most valuable assets. We protect our fleets, we protect our buildings, we protect our physical assets. And the most important assets that exist in most businesses are your people's time and attention. And we don't protect their time and attention. And because we don't protect it, they actually are working in an absolutely crazy environment where they really can't get the work that they're supposed to do done. And that's what his book is about. And what he describes is, he says, we've overcome this problem by creating an environment that's calm. And he shows you in the book how he's gone about not only getting it calm, but keeping it calm.
Now, what is the difference between a calm workplace and a complacent workplace? Because so many, I mean, especially in the industry that I'm in, which is in media and madness and breaking news. I mean, there's nothing more exciting. My producers may disagree. Yep, they disagree. My producers will disagree that at 5:30 in the afternoon, when three stories break all at once and suddenly we have to throw everything we've been preparing all day out the window and suddenly re-embark on a day from scratch with half an hour to airtime, is one of my favorite things in the world. It's chaos. It's mad. It's crazy. That is a good thing.
I think that there's certain contexts which have to be like that. I don't think that most contexts, most places where most people work bear a resemblance to a newsroom, which is up to date. I think that when you're talking about this calm, what he's suggesting is that if we take time, you're at work for plenty hours, in fact, far, far too many hours, based on what we know people work. And people who work 70 hours a week have been found by solid research to probably be really working for about 35 hours a week. And the reason for that is because an hour that's broken up seven times by interruptions, by meetings, by all sorts of other things, isn't an hour. It's just a few minutes scattered all over the place and doesn't produce what it needs to produce.
Correct.
So if you want to get more done, he says, my company, we only work 8 hours a day. That's it. In fact, in the summers, they work less than that. And he says to me, when you go home, you close the laptop and you come back the next day. Now, the question is, how's that possible? And the answer is, because what we do, because we interrupt so much, we work longer and longer hours. And we put in more, but the fact is that just takes away from the other parts of life that give life meaning, which is where the work-life balance comes in, I suppose. And your life doesn't become a whole bunch of leftovers from work, but the life part of it is actually there because you have much more time to do it. He believes that people produce better. One of the things he mentions is that exhaustion is often seen as a badge of honor, instead of being an act of stupidity. The fact is, he says, the key is to waste less. He says we waste an enormous amount of time at work, and
I'm sure you've told us this. Sorry, Ian, I'm interrupting. I'm simply illustrating the point that interruptions are bad. you've told us there's a law, isn't there? I mean, Mark Moore's law that computing power would double every 18 months. There's another law that suggests that work expands to fill the available space and time that you have in a day. If you've got 2 hours, you'll get the work done in 2 hours that you had eight for yesterday.
Indeed, and I think what it does do, saying, listen, you are only going to work 8 hours a day, there's two things that have to happen. One is the context itself has to be appropriate. And if we have a look at, first thing is cut out as much waste as you possibly can so you can get what really has to be done. There's a second part to it. Second part is treating people, your colleagues, with respect. And I'll tell you what that means. The fact that I'm sitting at my desk doesn't mean I'm available. I'm probably at my desk because I'm working. And people will interrupt you all the time because they see you there. So the first part of getting an environment which is calm is showing colleagues respect. We live in an environment where we're able to instantly communicate with people. But the fact that you can instantly communicate in real time with me doesn't mean that I need to be responding to you in real time. There are probably very, very few things that can't wait. And waiting is okay. The sky won't fall down. The company won't fold. But it will become a more comfortable and calmer place to work in. That's one aspect. The second aspect is we work in, a lot of people work in open plan offices, and that's not going to change fast. But the biggest example of a successful open plan office is something we've all experienced all over the world all the time, and that's called a library. A library is a place where people do work, but the place is quiet. And he says, in our company, we work on library rules. You don't go around talking loudly, annoying people, interrupting. Remember, the most important thing you have is human beings' time and attention. And we want to see that those things are protected as much as we possibly can. And one more, he mentions many things here which I think are very useful. But one of them is, we've always said a good work ethic is somebody who's available to you 24 hours a day and he'll work as hard as he can. A good work ethic isn't that at all. A good work ethic is somebody who doesn't let their colleagues down. and who's a pleasure to work with and doesn't increase the burden on other colleagues. If that's all they ever did, you'd have to say that that person has a really, really nice work ethic. And all the other stuff is fluff.
Ian Mann from Gateway's Business Consultants. Food for thought as always. What a lovely sounding book. Jason Fried is the author. It doesn't have to be crazy at work. Do we understand, colleagues? Behave like you're in a library. Shut up and stop interrupting. Oh, that's me. Ian Mann, thank you very much indeed from Gateway's Business Consultants.
The Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
So Desmond Dube, unfortunately not well today. So Make Money Mondays brought to you by Sunlum Private Wealth, your wealth, our craft. What we've done is gone into the archives and we have dug up the interview that we did with Jesse Clegg some time ago. It's one we prepared earlier, a rebroadcast of my Make Money Mondays personal edition chat with the wonderful Jesse Clegg.
I mean, it's kind of hard to analyze because you are...
It was normal.
Yeah, it's just the norm, I guess. You know, I was kind of used to when I was very young, sort of the first 6 years of my life was spent mostly on the road in hotels and airports and tour buses and traveling all over the place, Europe, America, and all over South Africa. And it was a wonderful time. I mean, I saw so much amazing music and met some amazing people, and it was a great kind of education on music and also on life.
But it didn't put you off. I mean, clearly the bug bit really early.
I mean, it did in a way. I mean, I always had this feeling of all these eyes were on me, you know, if I was going to do music or not. And it never really bit full on until I actually started writing my own music when I was about 14. But you know, and I also got to see the unglamorous sides of the music industry, you know, the travel and, you know, my family was split up for months on end, and how difficult it can be as a full-time career artist. So I kind of got the best of both worlds, and I had a very sort of disillusioned view of what being a musician was. So it was only when I actually discovered that I myself was extremely passionate about expressing myself through music that I thought I could give it a shot.
And it's working for you, it would seem. I mean, you're doing a lot of travel. You are doing, you've fallen into that trap. You've done
definitely.
A big 7-week tour of 2014. You've just, I see you in LA recently, just looking at your Twitter
feed. Yeah.
You get around a lot.
Yeah. I actually got back from LA last week and then went straight to Dahlstrom for a festival.
All the big lights, eh?
Yeah. So it's the traveling is intense. I mean, you do a lot of, a lot of moving around. You know, when we go on tour in December, I do 25 shows on average, and we do about 10,000 kilometers on the road in sort of 4 weeks. So, you know, you kind of have to get used to it. And it's probably my least favorite thing about doing music. But when you get up on stage and you play to an audience, and you can feel that connection, it really makes it worthwhile.
How important is the physical appearance, going and doing concerts, doing shows to groups of people, to your fans, people who pay money to come and watch you? That's fine. It may help cover the costs of the touring and stuff. But getting the albums bought and getting people downloading the albums,
it's becoming less and less important, to be honest. You know, the music, the actual physical album and having the stuff out online is almost becoming like a promotional tool to get people to your shows at this point.
Okay.
You still make money on streams and iTunes and stuff, but it's nothing like it was, you know, even in 2010. You know, when on my first album, we went platinum, and that was my main source of income, was album sales. Now, physical albums, actual CDs, people don't really buy them anymore. So, you know, your income is coming from streams and from iTunes and stuff like that. So the income stream has kind of dissipated, and musicians are having to go out on the road a lot more, just on a global scale.
Completely. I mean, we see so many of the tours that people do, and you go, surely they don't need to do that. And maybe they do it just because they want to get back on the road. Because there's got to be something special about it. I mean, as exhausting as it can be,
yeah.
As you get towards December and you're going in your big 25-gig tour, you've got to be going, okay, I'm looking forward to the first five.
business.
Yeah. No, I always look forward to it, man. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's always an awesome time. And, you know, you play all, I mean, I play all kinds of shows, from festivals to intimate theaters to acoustic shows to clubs. You know, I do a whole lot of different stuff in December because there's so much happening around South Africa. So it's just this wealth of just music, you know, and it's wonderful when you go to a new town and you play to people for the first time who haven't seen you before, or you're playing to people who have seen you and they know all the songs, you know, that kind of organic sort of connection that you get from a live show that kind of just lasts for that hour and a half and then it goes away and we all go our separate ways. That little moment you have is such a special thing, man. It's truly magical.
Now, let's talk money, because that's what we need to do. Traveling the world on the tour buses, traveling the world, going to the concerts, going backstage, seeing, I'm sure, in the world of rock and roll and the world of pop, and you would have seen huge excess. You would have seen people behaving incredibly well and people behaving incredibly badly. Mm. What was your sense of money as a kid?
I mean, you know, I grew up in a family that really emphasized like the internal versus the external, you know, the value of ideas, the value of communicating and committing yourself versus material sort of symbols of status. That was sort of far more impressed on me than the opposite, you know. So I've always been quite cautious with money, I think, and I've also, you know, my biggest expenses are actually just investing back in my art mostly. you know, I'm not someone who you know, spends on lavish sort of luxury items or anything like that. I've always been kind of cautious, and I've also had a clear sense of you know, if I want to do this for the rest of my life, I have to have money. You know, that relationship between art and money is such a tenuous one, but you know, you get to a point where you realize that as an artist, you actually have to be quite a good businessman, and you have to read your contracts, and you have to know how much tax you're paying and how much, you know, what you're spending on things. And that was a lesson that I've learned kind of over the years, and it's been very useful.
I remember doing a TV interview with your dad about 5 years ago, and I said to him, like, do you ever see yourself retiring? And at the time, he was fit and he was well, and he was about to go on tour, I think, to Europe, and going, I can't retire. I pull a long train, he said. And he's got this deep sense of responsibility to the bands, to the road crews, to the many, many people, and he did much bigger format shows and stuff in those days, I'm sure, than you do. You travel light as a musician, much lighter. You don't have that same sort of burden, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you learn how to prioritize, and you know, one of the best things that I did, having done all these tours, and you know, when I started out, I was signed to a label, and you know, there's this kind of this middleman between you and your finances that you don't really know where the money's going or where it's being spent, and it's just this kind of gray haze.
And you don't know how much you're going to get every
month. Yeah, it's just sometimes you have money, sometimes you don't have money, sometimes you just... And then eventually when I decided to go independent, I actually had a direct relationship with my finances, and I, for the first time, I was like, wait a second, there's far better ways of doing this, and I don't know why we haven't been doing this, you know? Just for example, like when we went on tours, we would rent, you know, sound systems and gear and lighting and all that stuff. And when you get to the end of the tour, you realize that you've just spent what it costs to buy all this equipment on renting it. and you know, so then you just take a knock on one of the tours and you buy the stuff, and then you never have that cost again, you know. So those silly little things that, you know, you never think about, and actually
that's business, though. I mean, that's the difference between the art and the business.
Totally, man. So now, you know, now when I go on tour, I tour with all my own infrastructure. You know, luckily we've got amazing sponsors as well. You know, my sponsors at Ford have given us a tour bus, and I own all the lighting and all the sound, and so I don't have any production costs. We go out on tour, and it's just far less stressful, and it's allowed me to earn more money, which is fantastic.
And we're going to find out what you do with that money in just a little while. My guest this evening is Jesse Clegg. He is developing a very, very clear Jesse Clegg sound. He has been traveling extensively, doing lots and lots of gigs, not only here in South Africa, but traveling the world as well. More with Jesse Clegg in a moment.
702. SMS Bruce on 31702. The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
Part two with Jesse Clegg, the musician, this evening. A rebroadcast of a previous episode. Desmond Dube, tonight's scheduled guest, unfortunately lost his voice. So we've got Jesse Clegg in fine voice instead.
You know, for a long time, when I started out, all my money just went back into my career. And eventually I got to a point where I was like, you know, I can, maybe I'm investing all my eggs in one basket here. You know, you never know. You know, music is one of those unpredictable things, and you never know what's going to happen. So last year I bought a house, and I'm living there now in Joburg. So hopefully that's going to be a good asset at some point. And yeah, I do a little bit of, I buy some shares sometimes. I'm not a pro at that, but, you know, my dad and my brother are both, my brother's obsessed with Bitcoin.
Oh,
and my dad is, well, he believes it is, man. So you can have a long debate with him about that. My dad also gives me advice and stuff.
Short debate. Is your dad good at investing?
Yeah, he's very good, you know, and he'll always let me know if there's a hot share on the market, so I'll jump in at the right time. But I don't, I'm not like reading all the info about it. I just kind of go off of his advice.
Oh dear.
Yeah, sometimes it hasn't worked out though. I'll tell you that much.
what's the worst bit of advice Johnny Clegg has given you?
Oh man, I don't know. It's never been terrible, but it's also like. The thrill of the risk, you know. So I think there's also an aspect of it that we both just enjoy in terms of like, let's just see what happens, you know, let's put this in and maybe we'll make some money and we kind of just watch it together and it's kind of an exciting little father-son thing.
You could just get a series and sit on the
couch. Yeah, I know. It would be probably a lot cheaper.
Exactly. And as much of a thrill and it costs much less.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Okay, so he hasn't given you a disastrous tip. Has he given you a great tip?
He gave me a very good one last year. I bought Blue Label, actually. And it was just, I don't know, sorry, it wasn't. It was MTN.
Blue Label wouldn't be good. And
no, look, it was MTN. And I bought right at the right time, and I actually made quite a good little pocket money on that one. So thanks, good. Dad.
Well done, Dad. were you treated like a grown up as a kid? I mean, you were on the road with grown ups, living a very grown up life from a very early stage. But from a money perspective, were you treated like a grown up?
Yeah, I mean, both me and my brother, we never felt any pressure to do music or to do art or anything like that. We always felt like whatever we did, as long as we loved it and that we committed to it and we were disciplined and we had passion, that was more important than actually the content of what you were doing. Just the way you engage with your work was very important. And I think that's given both of us a very sort of strong sense of being able to really stick it out, you know, stamina. You can't have stamina without being passionate. And and I've been around for a few years now, so I feel pretty good.
I mean, you've been in the music business for 10 years, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
pretty much. My first album came out when I was 19, so yeah.
19, yeah. Were you studying at all? Did you study? Did you have
I did a law degree at WITS. And I did an honors degree in English literature at the University of Toronto. I actually did my honors degree in Toronto while I was recording my second album.
Cool.
Which was very stressful.
We're reading all those books and having to record at the same time.
Yeah, like writing my thesis and recording an album and reading, you know, two books a week. And it was pretty intense, but I wrote some good songs.
But did that help? I mean, the blend of literature and broadening your mind and understanding
absolutely
this enormous richness in literature, and it helps people, artists, see the world differently to the rest of us.
Completely. I mean, you know, I really enjoyed literature. I did. I majored in law and English literature, and but I did philosophy and politics and other stuff. But just as you say, the broadening of your perspective, broadening of your vocabulary as well, which is very good for lyrics. And and also just, you know, reading great works of art, you know, just being exposed to incredible art that's withstood the test of time, and thinking about it, engaging with it in a very intense way was very stimulating for me. I mean, I wrote songs. There's songs on my second album that I wrote about characters in books that I was reading. That's how engaged I was in it.
Sure. Johnny Clegg's son, of course, Jesse Clegg. He's his own man. I don't have to say Johnny Clegg's son. I can say Jesse Clegg. Musician. Make Money Monday's special edition guest about a year ago when MTN was at a much higher share price than it is now. Hopefully, he made a good turn on it. And MTN's share price today, incidentally, recovering very nicely indeed. But Johnny Clegg, of course, not very well. But Jesse Clegg, taking the world by storm. And Jesse Clegg joined us on Make Money Mondays about a year ago.